Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us, the Murray family, through their Facebook page, or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray. Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawlspace Studios in Wormtown. How are you, Lance?
Couldn't be better. How are you today?
I'm doing great. We have a really great interview with a wonderful woman named Marissa Jones. You may be familiar with the name. She does the Vanished podcast, very popular true crime podcast about missing people.
It's such a great person to speak with. Such a good conversation, and I remember talking and looking down and realizing that 45 minutes had gone by and didn't even realize it. And afterward, she really leaves you with a sense of thinking about your place in this, in what we do in this industry. She talks about how each one of the cases that she works on and when she works with the family and how she takes part of that with her. How she takes part of that stress with her and how she takes part of that turmoil with her. So she really wears it on her sleeve, which leaves you with a sense of feeling for her and feeling for these families and these cases.
I mean, we can really relate to what she goes through in a lot of ways because we do a podcast on a missing person. And so we have run into some of the same issues and things like that. So it really is fun and great to talk to a colleague like this in this field of podcasting and, you know, true crime media, which is essentially what we do, trying to shed some light on these cases that need some publicity.
And it's not always about delivering this groundbreaking information or uncovering the new clue that's going to lead to something. We also sprinkle in episodes like this where it's more of a how-to of an approach. As a listener, as someone who does this for a living, how do you approach a case like this? How do you approach a cold case? And as a listener, how do you approach the people doing this? And how do you approach the family?
It's all got to be done very thoughtfully, Lance.
Exactly. And this is after so many episodes, there's a lot of facets to what we decide to put out there to the public. And talk to an expert like Marissa, who is doing this as well. And it's not, again, it's not just about presenting the facts. It's about presenting an entire mindset of how to approach it.
Okay, so we'll play the interview in just a moment. But before we do, I wanted to let you know about something really interesting that we're doing over on Stitcher Premium. You can check out stitcher.com/premium, subscribe, and what you'll get from Crawlspace Media, Lance, is...
I've heard of them.
Yeah, that's us. The back catalog of the podcast Crawlspace. You will get season 2 of Empty Frames that we're working on, and for the first time ever, I think, you will get what we're calling creator's commentary, and it's of the first 10 episodes of Missing Maura Murray. So the first 10 episodes came off of the public feed, and they are still available, but only on Stitcher Premium. And so when you subscribe, you will get those, but you will also get creator's commentary in addition.
I can't stress enough how cool the creator commentary is, because I personally don't know of any other show that's done that. There are so many episodes, and we've gone through such an arc with our journey here, especially with Maura's case. And if you go back and you listen to the early episodes, we often talk about how they're cringeworthy. This gives us an opportunity to go back to those early episodes, address what made us feel cringeworthy, more importantly, address things that were put out there that were not factual, but we kept in because it's part of the journey, and we comment over it, much like you'd see in a director's cut or a director's commentary of a movie.
Yeah, and we've talked about and kind of wrestled with taking down some of these early episodes. So now they are kind of down from the public feed, but instead of losing them, throwing them in the trash forever, they're still there if you want to dive in. But you get how we feel about them now, which is us 3.5 years later.
And how many times have we been asked, guys, what were you thinking when you said that? Like, what were you thinking when you kept calling Maura a girl and not a young woman? And you get to hear what we were thinking about our behavior and what we said way back then.
We are pretty hard on ourselves, Lance.
And you'll get some laughs when you listen to that, when you listen to us being critical of ourselves. But you'll also get corrections of facts, and you'll also get what we know now in relation to what we are delivering back then. So it is, like I said, it's like a director's commentary over a movie. So we have 80 episodes right now that we'll be delivering to you, and you'll be getting them monthly starting this month in batches of 10.
So you can listen to the full archive of Missing Maura Murray now on Stitcher Premium, completely ad-free and re-edited with new bonus commentary. So go to stitcherpremium.com and use promo code MMM for a free month of listening. Okay, so we hope you enjoy the interview with Marissa Jones of The Vanished Podcast, and subscribe to Stitcher Premium. I think you'll really like it. There's a lot of great stuff on there. There's a show that True Crime Garage does and a lot of great comedy albums. So check that out and follow us on Twitter at Maura Murray Doc. We're also on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you very much. We are being joined by Marissa Jones of The Vanished Podcast. How are you today, Marissa?
I'm doing well. How about you guys?
We're doing very well. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a while. We've been wanting to have you on for so long, and we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to do this with us today. Speaking of your busy schedule, how did you find time to do this today?
Well, I took some time. I planned out my holiday season ahead of time this year. The past two holiday seasons, I overextended myself and didn't leave enough time for, you know, just family stuff. So this year I said, all right, I'm going to go and get ahead. And so I set little goals for myself to, like a schedule for myself to work and get ahead. So I actually got myself done all my episodes for the remainder of the year, and I just finished yesterday, so I'm like, for once in 3 years, I actually got ahead, so I'm
wow.
pretty happy.
I'm so jealous. Yeah, so you said 3 years. You've been doing The Vanished for 3 years. Tell us about the journey of your podcast.
So I started the show in the beginning of 2016, and I just had this... At the time, I was working as a paralegal, and my work, I was kind of getting pushed into, I would say, more boring work. And I felt like I really enjoyed the research that I would do at work. And so I started putting a little bit of that into looking into some missing persons cases. And I noticed that as far as podcasts go, or were at the time, if you're looking back to beginning of 2016, there wasn't much out there as far as covering missing persons that aren't well-known cases. So I kept finding these cases that I thought were interesting, but nobody was covering. So I actually asked some of the shows that were existing at the time to cover them, and nobody seemed very interested. So one day I was like, I'll just do this myself. I had no clue what I was doing. I know you guys have background in producing things, and I have a legal background. So when I started the show, I was learning as I went along, but so I'm kind of a self-taught kind of person as far as the audio end of things goes. But
that's really impressive, because there's a lot that goes into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I started kind of just researching stuff and then creating episodes. But then I was like, okay, now I see why people don't cover these cases, because there's not enough information out there. You actually have to go and talk to people. And that's when my show took a sharp turn, I think, in the direction that it has been for a very long time, where I talk to people. And as time goes on, I've been trying to do more, especially with older cases where I have the opportunity, I try to track down as much as I can by doing like Freedom of Information Act requests and really trying to bring something new to the public, a story they haven't heard, information that hasn't been released. And so that's kind of where, my show evolved from. And now a lot of my episodes will have a single interview, but what I'm trying to do now is get more people. So an episode might have four people in it. And I think that brings a more well-rounded view of a case. You know, if you can get a family member, a friend, and a police officer, you know, that kind of thing, or an expert, depending on the situation.
Wow. So yeah, this is a very time-consuming job for you. This is obviously your full-time job.
Right. At the beginning of, I would say, I think it was March 2017, I was able to, because of advertising, I was able to leave my job. And I felt like in the lead up to that the work that I was doing was helping people more than the work I was doing at my job. And I would spend my time at work thinking about like, oh, I have to do this, and I'm interviewing this person tonight. And I just felt like this was pulling me. This is what I wanted to do. And so it was scary leaving my job, because you know how it is. You never know when the bottom's going to fall out on something. But I'm glad that I did, because I think that it's enabled me to improve the show. You can only do that, you know, coming home from work and then working till 2 a.m. for so long.
Yeah.
You just said your current or your previous job wasn't as helpful as what you're doing now with the podcasting. What does that mean? When did you realize that what you do now was more helpful than working as a paralegal?
The work that I was doing, it was important work. A lot of what I was doing was helping people through really rough times in their life, you know, whether they were going through a divorce or bankruptcy, that kind of thing. And you were helping people through this rough period. And I was always the go-to person, because the attorney's always busy in and out of court. So I was the person that they would call upset because this happened or that happened. But when you have people who have someone that's missing and they're not gaining any traction with getting their story out there, the news isn't picking up on it, nothing. And giving them a space, a voice, is so meaningful to them that all of a sudden that nobody's been listening to them. It could be months, years, who knows. And then all of a sudden they have this support. They have support from listeners, and and they have an outlet where they can say, hey, this is my story. If you want to listen to it, here's a link. And anybody can listen to it anywhere for free. So it gives people a voice, really. And it's something that's always available and accessible to anybody with an internet connection. So even if you know, it's not like I go out and solve crimes every week, right? But you're helping someone. And when you hear from people week to week that they're so thankful for this thing that you spend a lot of time creating for them, that to me was very meaningful. And that's something that I felt was more meaningful than what I was doing at my job.
That's great to hear. I can see it. Now you also have a pretty good social media following. What's that like? Do you do something different on social media than you do on the podcast, or how do your Facebook groups
not
work?
Really. I have a really big group on Facebook. It has about 20,000 people in it, and it seems as though people like to go and talk about the cases, and a lot of the families are also in the group. And so it gives people a place to go and say, like, oh, I was listening and I had this question, and they can kind of interact with these people. It's not like you just watched a program on television and you have 20 questions about it and you just go to Google and try to see if there's more information. A lot of times the people are right there to answer their questions. And I think that is a draw for people. But also a lot of the people who listen to my show are just very supportive, and they might not have a question, but they want to say, you know, I just want you to know that your story really touched me. And I think that means a lot to people in itself, just to hear that somebody listened and it meant something to them.
When that first started happening for you, was it a surprise that people were reaching out to you directly, and how did you handle that?
Well, it was interesting because I started getting, I think at first it was just your normal amount of people coming in, but when you see people just reaching out to support others, that's like a wonderful thing. I think so much of what we see on social media today is ugliness and people just throwing out flippant comments without a thought of who's going to see it or be affected by it.
One of my favorite words, by the way. I got to use that. Yeah. Flippant. So good. Sorry to interrupt.
No, no problem. But I think that seeing a community of mindful people who just want to help or be supportive is a reminder that there's a lot of wonderful people in this world. And so for every crappy thing that somebody says to you, it's a reminder, like, you know, don't focus on that. Focus on this.
Yeah.
Putting something positive into this world and keeping that going.
Yeah. You are putting something positive out there. You, like you said, families want this coverage. Your audience obviously wants it. You're doing something good. This is great. Now, you mentioned kind of some backlash or criticism. I noticed that you do post about that sometimes on social media. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I've had people come at me for, several different ways. And one of the things that I've gotten is saying that you cover too many people who have an addiction issue, or somebody recently said you cover too many people, too many cases that are likely suicides. And that stuff really, I mean, a lot of my cases, before I actually talk to people, I have no idea that there's an addiction issue involved, because there's nothing or hardly anything on the internet except for a little bit of a rundown on, you know, so-and-so was last seen here. If you have any information, call this agency. So, you know, if you're going to cover somebody, a lot of times you're going to uncover things that aren't like a pretty little story that's all wrapped up in a bow. And obviously, you know this with Mara Murray, right? You start digging into her story, and you know, she isn't just this, perfect college student runner kind of thing. I mean, there's darkness to her story that comes to light. And I feel like if you're going to try to put somebody's story out there, if you, it's dishonest to withhold information if you find it. And also, I think withholding that information doesn't get you any closer to finding the truth. So, you know, a lot of times these things that people don't like are things that are risk factors for going missing or becoming the victim of a crime. And you're going to see more cases like that than the ones that it's just some perfect person with no issues in their past getting kidnapped off the street, street corner. So, you know, it's the reality of missing persons cases. So other times I've had some, and I'm sure you guys can relate to this, strange interactions with internet sleuths.
Nah, who never happened once.
This is news to us.
Yeah. Who kind of act like they own a case, or you shouldn't be speaking on it. It's theirs. They've been investigating, you know, let's like air quotes this, investigating this for years or whatnot. And they seem to like have a claim on it. And it's an odd thing to me to see that. And other times it's people who kind of butt in and then act like they're helping. And then they turn on the families and they start saying nasty things about them all over the place. And I'm like, how does this even happen? Who has time to do this to people? You know, setting up a website to basically slander a family of a missing person. It's nuts. So, I've seen all kinds of things, and it does get frustrating at times, but you know, the more people that listen, the greater chance you're going to have a run-in with this kind of thing. And it just happens, and it's going to continue to happen.
We can forward you a great paper that was written by Professor Elizabeth Yardley and David Wilson. They're in the UK, and we had them on as a guest on Crawl Space, where they talked about this thing called the wound culture, W-O-U-N-D, wound culture. And it's exactly, you defined it and you didn't even realize you did. It's when these people interject themselves in with the family. And then once the family recognizes that they're more destructive than they you know, originally thought or thought at all, and they try to distance themselves, then these people start to badmouth the family. They start to, like you said, they create websites, or they'll create different monikers, and they'll go on Reddit and they'll argue with themselves just to discredit the family. It's a really sad and morbidly fascinating phenomenon when you're doing something like this.
Yeah, and it's I've seen it where this one woman was posting posting their address, a picture of their house, that name and address of this family. They have a child who's a minor, of her school. And I'm like, who thinks this is okay? And so, I mean, I see it and I just go, I don't know. I feel horrible because some people can fight these people to get like a website taken down, and other people don't have the resources to do so. And it's just a level of harassment that people who are already going through something terrible don't need.
Right. They don't have the resources or the energy. You think about these people who are like looking for their loved one. They've been fighting that fight for however long, and then they have to fight this other thing. And it's easier to just say like, I'm not going to do that. But, and that's mm-hmm. unfortunate.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, Marissa, that, you know, we obviously do the podcast Missing Maura Murray. And, you know, if you ever covered Maura Murray's case on your show, we would start a webpage slandering your podcast.
Don't you dare.
So stay out of our space. No, I'm actually completely kidding. We welcome more coverage and love when people cover Maura's case. So if you ever wanted to do that, we would welcome that, and we'd even come on to talk about it if you want to. But let's talk about Maura's case, because you're a missing persons expert in this field. So what do you think about where do you want to start with Maura's case?
Well, it's kind of funny in a way. I get, not so much anymore, but I would say maybe for the first 2 years or so, I have a case submission form on my website, and I got a lot of case submissions that read a lot like, have you ever heard of Maura Murray? And, you know, of course, yes, I definitely have, but, you know, I had followed her case. I remember watching it years ago on Disappeared. I had listened to your show, and, you know, when I speak about it now, I have a different perspective than I would have, say, 3 or 4 years ago, where I think that I used to look at things from a perspective of, you know, this is suspicious or that is suspicious. And, you know, you kind of look for the most creepy scenario or the most scary scenario that could happen. But after doing this for a few years and seeing some cases come to a resolution, and a lot of times the resolution is a lot less creepy or scary than what you expected, or you know, after spending a lot of time looking at statistics about stranger abduction, that kind of thing, and how rare that actually is, I think that, you know, several years ago I may have said to you, oh, I think she was abducted and murdered. But I think now I kind of lean more towards, you know, this is a young woman who had a lot of things not going right for her, and a lot of those things were because of choices that she made, and, you know, things, her relationship wasn't perfect, her, you know, she had crashed her dad's car, she had now just crashed another car, and I could see somebody in her situation being afraid of getting a DUI and running off, and whether, you know, she succumbed to the elements or whether she did get into a car with somebody or whatnot. You know, it's I don't really subscribe to these theories so much about, you know, somebody, the, you know, tandem car thing and that kind of thing. I don't think that this was a really long-term planned out thing. I think that she was kind of just a young person being, what's the word? You know,
impulsive.
Yes, impulsive. Thank you. And that's kind of how I look at it now. You know, I wonder if we'll ever know the answer as to what happened to her. Do you guys feel like at this point you've covered her case, you've been following it for so long, do you feel like there will be a resolution?
I think that there will be a resolution. My feelings change pretty much daily on how that's going to happen and how long it'll take. I feel like I don't feel like when we get an answer, it's going to be a complete answer. I think it's going to be a really partial answer. And you can think about that in many ways. Maybe something of hers is found, and that just leads to why is it there and where did it come from and how long it's been there? Or it could be someone on their deathbed confessing to something and then they die and then you don't have anything else beyond that one 30-second deathbed confession. Unfortunately, I think that is how we're going to get the first concrete answer. It's not going to be gift wrapped to us no matter how hard we work on it, unfortunately.
Yeah, Doug, yeah. Police work, leads. This case is out there pretty good. This case has leads and tips that come in regularly, so that needs to continue eventually. This could lead to a resolution, but yeah, we're definitely hopeful.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of times, in, you know, not just with her case, but with a lot of cases where you have somebody who goes missing and there's this whole you know, could they have wandered into the woods situation? You go, well, how have they not been found, and how has their belongings that we know were with them, their clothing, a backpack, etc., has that not been found? And I have seen some cases where there were searches and searches done for people, and the person ends up being found either where they had already searched or like right next to where they had already searched, like very close proximity to where they had already looked. And you go, how does that happen? I can't fully explain it.
Oh, it's because the murderers bring the body back after storing them for several years or an amount of time, and then they bring them back and put them there and cover them with leaves, and then they're found.
Yeah, well, that's I have heard those kinds of things too, and I think people always rush to that kind of. There has to be a suspicious element to that too.
Yeah, no, I'm actually being sarcastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know.
No, I just want to be clear. But yeah, mm-hmm. that is something that we've heard as well, and I don't really know how that happens either. But I guess it has to be accepted by us and the community as something that does happen.
I think you got to look at the time frame for all of that as well, and the time, not only the time frame between when this person disappeared to when they were found, or an article of clothing was found, or their remains were found. You have to look at the time period between those two occurrences, and you also have to look at the time period in the sense of what year did it take place in. With Moore's case, it's been almost 15 years, and there's been so many searches in that area. We've been there, and we've done GPR, cadaver dogs, and digging right around the area of the crash. And with the podcast, and with what you do with The Vanished, I mean, there's so much out there for people to gravitate to and do their own searches, like we've seen with Boots on the Ground. So I'm sure in the 90s or the early 2000s, when podcasting wasn't a thing and crowdsourced information wasn't really a thing, you couldn't have someone doing their own independent and responsible search and find somebody or an article of clothing that was right there. I will say that in the past few years, since we've started working with different members of law enforcement, both current members of law enforcement and retired, we've seen many people who are completely unaffiliated with Moore's disappearance forwarding photos of something that they might have found up in the area, that's articles of clothing, and that gets forwarded to the cold case unit, and they follow up on that. So in the meantime, there have been things that have been found in that area, whether people have been searching for it or not, and still none of it has to do with Moore.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of those things. I think a lot of times when you look at a case, you go, oh, well, they did have dogs come out. They did search there. But I think that doesn't, just because that happened, we've seen it happen before and people have been found or something's been found. And I think that, you know, no search effort is 100% accurate, you know, the dogs aren't necessarily 100% accurate all the time, that kind of thing. And I think we put a lot of weight into those things, and it can just so happen that something was missed. I mean, you look at the woods, you've got leaves, you know, piles and piles of leaves and stuff. Things can go, you know, uncovered. So
yeah, for sure. And we've even found out, even in the past few months, working with the cadaver dogs and working with the cold case unit, that cadaver dogs, nothing is as
conclusive,
straightforward,
yeah,
and cut and dry as everyone, and including ourselves, were led to believe. If a cadaver dog doesn't hit on a certain area, that doesn't mean that you just like completely check that off the list. It means you'd go back there when the weather conditions might be a little bit different and try again. Never just say, well, the dog didn't hit, and you move away. You know, you mm-hmm. You can go back as long as you have permission to go on the property and the owners of the property don't mind. Keep going back and checking these things out because of what you're talking about, because sometimes it was right there under your nose, but some condition prevented you from seeing it.
Right.
Also, the information, just be what we've learned as well, and I don't know if it's the same for you, you need to take everything with a grain of salt. We had heard in the A-frame house that the cadaver dogs went bonkers in one of the closets, and only after working with cadaver dogs directly did we realize that going bonkers isn't a thing. If a cadaver dog has a hit, they sit down and they do the opposite of going bonkers. They sit down and they don't do anything. So
right.
For years, people had, and including us, had been going on this thing where the A-frame, where the cadaver dogs went bonkers. Well, if they went bonkers,
that must mean there was a dead body in there.
Right, but in reality, they probably went bonkers because they caught a scent of, like, a rabbit in the area or something.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah.
Yeah, and I also, and this is kind of strange, but somebody had contacted me and was telling me one time that they spoke to Maura Murray in Canada, and I was like, okay, I haven't covered her case. You know, there's probably other people that you should tell this information to, that kind of thing. And it kind of struck me at the time as one of these people who, I mean, how do you even... First of all, how do you know? You spoke to someone in Canada. How do you know for sure it was her? And second of all, why did she call you? That kind of thing. It was just a weird circumstance for me. I was totally thrown by the whole thing. And I'm sure you guys get that kind of thing all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm curious about that email. Was it like a recent sighting, or was it like a convoluted thing? Like, oh, I saw her 3 years ago, and I'm reaching out now because I noticed your podcast or something like that?
Well, I could probably find it for you and forward it to you, but it was a while ago.
Yeah.
I want to say it was probably around the end of 2016, because the person had an interest in another case that I covered, and he said that he had been looking into that case, Maura's case and Brianna's case, and he was making ties in between the three that seemed not very strong.
Yeah.
But then he said, but I talked to her in Canada. So I was like, whoa, what is this? But to me, at the end of the day, I was like, I don't know who this person is. And it's one of those situations where they seem very focused on Maura, but this other case that I had covered was just kind of like this person went missing a kind of around the same time, kind of in the same region, closer to Brianna. But it was just a weird thing. And I know that there had been a lot of speculation on whether or not she went and started a new life in Canada. But it's one of those things, like, to me, if somebody went and started a new life in Canada, I mean, she had stuff going on in her life that was less than ideal. But as far as I know, it wasn't anything to just completely walk away from. But that is always a thing, and it happens, and I've seen it happen with some cases I've covered, but it's typically usually men who do that, not as often women. And when women do it, they're usually fleeing an abuser. So, I mean, I don't know. It was just a weird, weird interaction that I had. But I assume that you guys get that stuff too.
Yeah, we definitely get stuff like that. And you can usually kind of, like you sounded like you did, you can kind of deduce where the person's coming from, or what they want out of this. Or, you know, maybe it sounds promising and that's something to forward to the cold case unit, because that is definitely something we take seriously. If someone says they spoke to someone or if they know something, that's definitely mm-hmm. something we take seriously and forward along. If the person is saying they spoke to Maura Murray and they're making connections between Brianna's disappearance and this other disappearance, which I want to ask you about, I think I know who it might be. You know, that those three cases likely probably have no connection, or if they mm-hmm. do, only two of them do, if he talked to Maura Murray. So that doesn't, you know what I mean? This has red flags there. Who is this other missing person that you were talking
It's, about? It's Donnie. That I covered him back in the fall of 2016, Donnie Messier.
Yep.
And he went missing. His truck's never been found.
Yep. Yeah, that is a somewhat similar scenario. I remember listening to that episode Yeah. So, what do you think? Do you think that one is in any way connected to Brianna's, perhaps?
No, I don't. I don't think they're connected at all. I think all three of them are probably their own separate circumstances.
Yeah, of course, I'm talking about Brianna Maitland. Just want to be clear there. She was 17 when she disappeared from Montgomery, Vermont on March 19th, 2004, about 6 weeks and 80 miles away from where and when Maura went missing.
Do you have any cases that are like that as well, as far as could be so close in time frame and proximity that you have to look at it and say, are these two related? And how do you approach that? Do you know what I mean?
I do have some. I have one that I've been working on for a really long time that hasn't been published yet because I'm still not done. I kind of have a juggling system where I have cases that have a different amount of research that is required that I want to do and people I want to track down and talk to. So I have covered some that it's questionable as to whether or not that it's related to somebody else, but I do have one that I've been working on for a very long time that it's two men who went missing within a short period of time, and there appears to be a connection between the two of them. And so what I've been doing is working on an episode about both of them, interviewing both of their families. I was able to get both of their case files. And that's what makes it so complicated, because it's also related to another shooting and then also related to a separate murder. And so it's this big twisted web of cases and trying to pick apart who's involved in this one and who's involved in that one and are they connected. It's a lot to go through. And then there was another one that I covered two women together in an episode. They actually disappeared 10 years apart, but they had the same abusive boyfriend and they're both missing. And he's been arrested for kidnapping the second one, but they haven't been able to find either of them and get him or to get him to confess to anything. So that one, the tie between those two is a little bit more direct, right? It's not a serial killer stranger situation. It's a known abuser situation that these two women had dated the same guy. So
now you mentioned that some of the cases that you've covered have had outcomes since you've covered them. What are the percentages of those outcomes? Like, how many of them are found human remains near where they went missing? How many of them turned out to be missing persons on the run? How many of them turned out to be murder victims?
Well, I'd have to do calculations.
No, I need it immediate, Marissa.
Yeah. I have one of the problems is that when remains have been found, that a lot of times they've been in the elements for so long that they can't determine a cause of death. So we don't know if they were a murder victim. We don't know if they may have, have overdosed on something or, you know, all these different scenarios that could happen, right? So it's the shame of it is when that happens, that question of did someone murder my loved one still haunts the families. Like, they found them, but they just don't have 100% closure. So that is one outcome. I've had a few that they believe were the person took their own life. But again, they can't say for certain because the person's remains were so far decomposed. Well, I'll tell you, this kind of goes back to the question you asked me about the connection between multiple cases. I covered, back in 2016, I covered these two teen boys who went missing 3 weeks apart. And they were, you know, initially the police were saying they were runaways, and then the parents were saying there was no reason for them to run away. They wouldn't do that. And well, first, the first boy goes missing, and they're saying he's a runaway. But then the second one goes missing 3 weeks later, and that's kind of weird. They're friends. And 3 weeks later, you think of kids running away together. They leave together. They don't leave 3 weeks apart. And so I covered this. I did an episode once in 2016, once in 2017. And then this past summer, 2018, is when they announced that they were arresting people. And it was four men had allegedly murdered these two teenage boys, and separately, 3 weeks apart. And so they were connected, as the parents had thought initially, and they had not run away. And currently, as it stands, the boys are still missing. The one guy did plea out, and then another one just went to trial, and he was found guilty. And the other two are pending. One was a juvenile at the time, and so they're trying to move his case out of juvenile court. He was 17, I believe. And then the other one, he is fighting on his competency, because apparently he has high-functioning autism, and they're saying that he's not competent to stand trial. So there's a whole battle going on between, is he or isn't he? So that's kind of where it stands now. But that was one where initially we thought there was a connection, and it did turn out to be a connection. And that one is kind of resolved, but for the families to have them still missing is very difficult.
Yeah, that sounds like a frustrating situation. And it also shows that you can't just immediately dismiss two cases being unrelated. Like, it just goes to show the investigative process has to be open the entire time for all possibilities.
Right. Yeah, and a lot of it, I believe, was initially... So the two boys were classmates, but their cases fell into two different jurisdictions, and there wasn't a whole lot of cooperation between the two initially. And so I think that was a frustration. Like, neither of them wanted any more than just their one case, right? By putting them together, it was complicating the whole situation. But it ended up being that they were connected. And like you said, it's unfortunate that they didn't take the first disappearance very seriously to start, because in that 3 weeks' time, if they had been able to really dig into that boy's social media messages and stuff, they would have known who he went with the night that he disappeared. And those are the same people who killed his friend 3 weeks later. So, you know, it kind of goes, when you see people get labeled as a runaway, a lot of time can get wasted.
That's an interesting point you make, and it's similar to what we hear a lot with Moore's case, and I'm curious to get your opinion on this. As a law enforcement officer, as a police officer who finds an abandoned car with clear evidence of someone drinking and possibly drinking and driving, no person there, and you have the situation where an adolescent young man, actually a boy, is gone, and the first instinct is to say he ran away like so many other kids his age run away. And with our case, it's, well, someone wanted to avoid a DUI, so she ran from her car, and she'll show up later on. What is your opinion on what law enforcement should do immediately? Because I know that people out there say these cases like yours and like Moore's, the law enforcement, it was just botched from the beginning. But if you put yourself back to that time period, are you supposed to be, do you want to be known as an alarmist? Do you want to be known as the guy or female? Do you want to be known as the officer who will always go to the worst case scenario and call out all the troops when it's probably statistically just someone who ran away? And does that hurt your credibility?
Yeah, and I do. I mean, I can see with Mara's case, I can see that situation where you're responding to a car and, you know, there's clearly an alcohol situation going on and inside. And I could see, I mean, because you actually see this, and I read this in my local newspaper, where there will be a crash and the person flees on foot because they're trying to avoid a DUI. And I think people in those situations, obviously, they're impaired and they're not making the best decisions, you know, if they're drinking and driving or driving after drinking. And so it's easy to assume, okay, this person's just like took off to somebody's house and they're hiding out and, you know, we'll catch up with them later. We'll tow this car and, you know, the person's going to come look for it eventually, right? I don't think that any officer responding to a situation like Mara's, like what they responded to when her car was initially found, I don't think that most officers will jump to, like, this is going to be the most infamous missing persons case and it's going to go unsolved for all these years. I just don't think that that's what most people think, because I'm sure that officers run into this scenario all the time and it doesn't end like that. So, you know, I do think a lot of times there is a lot of blame, but, it, you know, how many cases do they see of somebody just leaving the scene, or how many cases do they see of kids running away and turning up, you know, a week later because they're mad at their parents for taking away their cell phone or, you know, anything like that. It's tough. It's tough to predict which ones are going to be the ones that the resources should have been put into. It's easy to say in hindsight.
Do you ever find yourself defending law enforcement or defending that point of view from people who listen to your show?
Yeah, sometimes I do. Sometimes, just for instance, I covered a case a few weeks back, Caitlin Akins. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she disappeared from Virginia a few years ago. And the police, and we even talked to them for the show. Her detective was on the show. And her case is one where it's pretty obvious who was most likely responsible. And the police officer, the detective, spoke about this in the episode. She said, you know, he's really just gone into turtle mode, is what she said. He won't talk to anybody. He won't talk to the family. He won't talk to law enforcement. And he shut everybody out. And so at this point, what they're trying to do is find some evidence to help push the case forward. But, you know, as far as this guy goes, he's just built a wall of protection around himself. And some people are commented that they haven't done everything they should or could do. And I was thinking, but they really have done a lot. I mean, they did search warrants. They did everything they could do. What they haven't done is they can't force him to talk. You know, you can't make somebody come in and talk. If they go and they get a lawyer and the lawyer says, don't talk to the police, well, what else can they do about that? So I think there can be some misconceptions about law enforcement and, you know, making people talk or making people take polygraphs, that kind of thing. At some point, you know, we have these things built into our laws to protect innocent people, but sometimes guilty people can hide behind them as well. So, you know, not every case is perfect. And a lot of times, especially with older cases, you can have a detective on it now who's really great, but they'll tell you, you know, there were some mistakes made in the beginning, but we're trying to do everything we can today to figure out what happened. So I think that there are certain misunderstandings and things out there that people think that the police can just like get into somebody's iPhone and figure out what's going on. And that's easier said than done.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've experienced the same thing where we hear people say, well, they got to do this and they got to do that. And it's not that easy. Police, like you said, police just can't go up to John Q. Public and say, the online community is demanding that I look at your cell phone records from 10 years ago. It's just not, we don't live in that world. Like you said, we have laws that protect people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where on one hand, you look at all these unsolved cases and you look at what these people are going through. But then you, on the other hand, you look at people who today, I think we have an increased awareness about wrongful convictions, and we're seeing people get their convictions overturned because of new DNA evidence. And you go, okay, well, that is, I mean, just putting somebody behind bars doesn't necessarily mean that you've solved a case, and it's just as much of a tragedy to put somebody who's innocent behind bars, right? So you have to be careful about jumping to conclusions, and law enforcement really has to make sure, you know, a lot of times it's not even law enforcement, it's the DA's office who doesn't want to take a no body case. So where you can have the detectives who are like, this, we know this is who did it. It's just that the district attorney's office doesn't want to prosecute on a no body case. So, I mean, they're limited in very, you know, all different ways. So,
yeah, totally. What about Breonna Maitland's case? What are your thoughts on her disappearance?
Well, I definitely don't think that her disappearance was connected to Mara. Her case is one that, like, when you look, like, the visual, the picture of how her car was found does really give you the creeps. It's one that is unsettling. But I do feel like her case is very much centered on around the people who were in her life at that time. And I don't know. I mean, I've read all different theories on her case, but I just feel like her case, if they could figure it out, it'll be within the circle of people that she knew and that she had been hanging out with. That's where the answers lie. I feel like Mara's case is a little different in that, you know, she was not at home, right, where she goes missing. And so you have, it's more of a wider mystery. Like, it could be somebody who lived out here. It could have been someone driving through the area. It could be related to no one out here, you know? So you have all these other questions. I think her case has always just, Breonna's case is always just, it's mysterious, but I feel like it has connections with the people she was hanging out with. That whole story about her acting weird in the store beforehand and everything, all of that. I just feel like there's a connection there. They just haven't been able to find it. And I also feel like in her case, you're talking about like a small town area, and a lot of times people don't want to talk about what they might know or what they've heard, and that it's just, they may be in fear of whoever harmed Breonna.
Yeah, or they might be in fear of saying something that isn't true, and it's just based on their own bias towards a certain person, and then it just turns into a situation where they've wrongfully accused somebody in a small town.
Yeah. And there's hardly any law enforcement in the area.
Right. You did say something about, which made me think of this question. You said that Mara wasn't at home when it happened. She wasn't in her hometown when it happened. How much stock do you put into the things that happened in Mara's life before she went on this trip up north? Because Tim and I have this reoccurring moment where Tim will compare something that he did when he was 21 or didn't do when he was 21 to what Mara maybe have done when she was 21 or not done at 21. When you were 21 as a young woman, which was probably like 3 or 4 years ago.
Months ago.
Yeah.
Months ago. how much stock do you put into the things that happened in Maura's life which led her to get in her car and drive north?
Well, I do feel like when you're that age-ish and younger, a lot of times things can feel like they're the end of the world when they're not the end of the world. And I do think that, you know, you see kind of a buildup of issues or a snowballing of issues within her life where things aren't going well. And I do feel like, I know people have thrown out the possibility that she went up there to end her life or something. And while that's a possibility, we don't know. It kind of struck me as she was really under stress of multiple different things going on in her life that weren't going perfectly. And she just needed to get away. And that's how I took that to be. But I could be wrong. But I do feel like she, you know, when you're a kid and I do feel like when you're 21, depending on who you are and your life circumstances, you're transitioning from seeing your parents as like, oh, I don't want to get in trouble with my mom or my dad, to being, you know, well, I'll deal with my own problems kind of situation. So, you know, if at 21, I was very independent, had my own apartment, I hadn't lived at home since I was 18. If I crashed my car, it would have been on me. It would have been on, you know, my insurance. I was paying for my own cell phone bill. It wasn't attached to my boyfriend or something. So I feel like I was very independent, and getting into a car accident or any of these things would have been on me to deal with. But I feel like Maura was in a place where she was still a little bit more dependent on her dad. And when you're in that place and you keep like screwing stuff up over and over, it can be like you have that feeling of letting down your parents. And I do feel like that's a thing for her, or could have been a thing for her, is, you know, I let him down with this, and then this, and then this, and then, you know, my boyfriend's cheating on me and all this stuff. I could see that being a mountain of stress for somebody who's 21 years old.
Yep. One of the last questions I have here is one of the most common questions we get, and you probably know the answer now, having gone through the pre-interview process with us, that we kind of deal with these heavy subject matters with a bit of humor. How do you deal with these heavy subject matters?
So for me, what I do is usually after I have a real stressful interview, I'll just take a break and go spend some time with my kids. My little guy's home during the day. My two older kids are in school. But my little guy's here most of the time. I sent him out to go Christmas shopping during this, but he's usually here. He's 17 months old. So it's a real, like, if I can get up and go out of my office and go eat lunch with him or something, it really helps, bring my spirits up, I guess you could say. But one thing that I do is I don't schedule more than one interview in a day for, you know, talking to families and stuff, because it's just a little bit too draining for me. Sometimes one thing that helps me is to turn on some music, that kind of thing, or even just go watch something funny on YouTube, just to kind of take your mind out. But I'm one of those people that, I mean, like, if you listen to my show, there's almost always a very deep emotional element to it. But I kind of live in that emotional space where I always think from that place, right? So when I'm looking at something, like, I always am looking at it from how this must feel for this person, right? As a mom, or, you know, that kind of thing. And so I kind of live there, and for me, that's like an easy, like, I can put myself in somebody's shoes and try to imagine how they're feeling. And it, And somebody once told me that he said, this is somebody that I covered their story. He said, you take a little bit of everybody's grief with you along the way, and that you have to also take care of yourself. So, and I feel like that's very, very true in a way. And so one thing that I also do is when I take time off, I find it very hard not to work all the time because my office is in my house. So when I take time off, I go on a little trip, and then I completely disconnect myself from working and just focus on, you know, whatever, my family and doing whatever. And that is really helpful to me because I'm always, when I'm at home, if I'm not at my desk working, I feel like I should be. So those are kind of little things that I do. Like after Christmas, I'm going on a trip to Florida. So for a few days, and that will be, I'm not working at all situation.
That's really interesting that you said that about taking little pieces of the emotion with you. And in order to get away from it, you need to physically get away from where you do your work, which must be a bit of a challenge because what you work on can sometimes unfold in real time. And I'm sure there's part of you, I hope there is, I hope I'm not putting this in your head now, but I'm sure there's part of you that will see your time away and you, it must sort of itch at you a bit to think like, well, are things happening and I'm not there to see them happen, or I'm not there to be a part of it. Does that ever concern you when you take time off?
Well, you know, I'll tell you about a circumstance I had. It was last year, and we went away for a weekend. It was just a short little trip. I live in Pennsylvania, so we just went on this short little trip to the center of the state. It's pretty remote and beautiful out there. And while I was away, I found out that one of the people I had just covered maybe a few weeks to a month prior was found deceased. And I just, when I looked at my phone and I saw it, and you just don't expect it. It always blindsides you when this happens. You're never expecting somebody to be found, right? You have all these cases that go on what seemingly forever. And so when somebody's found, there's never a warning, right? You never see it coming. It just happens. And it can hit you at the most random time, but it's always like, on one hand, you're like, oh, well, I'm glad they were found. But on the other hand, it's like, well, this is a really sad outcome. And there was that little bit of hope that the person was still out there alive. And now that little bit of hope is gone. So, you know, that's always hard in it. And I always have my phone with me, even though I say I disconnect. But, you know, you look down and you have some Facebook notification and it's just right there. So it does happen. And, you know, like there was another one I covered around the same time. And the guy was found buried in the backyard of the house he was last seen at. And everybody had a suspicion that this gentleman did not leave this house that he was last seen at. And so it shouldn't have been a big surprise. It was what everybody expected. But I don't think that anybody expected him to be found buried in the backyard of this house. I think they expected him to be dumped somewhere or something. But you just don't expect it. Like if somebody called you tomorrow and said, oh, we found Maura Murray, you would probably fall off your chair. I mean, it's just, you don't expect it to happen. And it's shocking when it does.
Yeah, we definitely have daydreams about that moment.
Yeah, I wouldn't even, I'm going to need to pad the floor because, yeah, I would fall off the chair.
Yeah, you would. You would be, because then, and then you'd be like, but where, you know, what are all the circumstances? And sometimes it's not immediately clear, but especially when you have a case that's gone on for as long as her case has, but it's pretty, it's always, and when you least expect it, that something like that happens. But it is hard, and just trying to take time to take care of yourself is important. Because, you know, if you're doing something with the end goal of helping people, but you burn yourself to the ground doing it, you can't help as many people as if you take care of yourself along the way.
Yeah, that's as much as the responsibility is to the case you're working on, you have an equal amount of responsibility to yourself to maintain your health and mental well-being in order to pursue that the case.
Yeah.
So what's next for The Vanished?
I have an episode. Well, I'll tell you as a whole that what I'm trying to do for next year is, and I've already been working on this, is to, I've hired some people to help me. And so I'm not just doing this all by myself anymore, because there's, you can only keep improving as one person as much, you know, a certain amount until you've kind of hit the limit of what one person can do in a week's time. Right. So I have some people helping me on the research end of things. And so my goal is to be getting more people on episodes and more experts and things, but also like my next episode that I have coming out, I'm excited about it because it's a local case to me, and I've been working on it since August, and I have the missing woman's family. I have her brother and her niece. I have the retired detective who worked on this for much of his career. How often do you hear a detective say that they got to work on this one case, only this one case, for 14 months straight?
Yeah, never.
Never. But yes, he worked on this one case for 14 months and no other case, but continued to work on it after that. And it was the case that you know how a lot of times you'll hear a detective say, like, this was the one case I wanted to solve before I retired. Well, this is that case to him. And so he retired several years ago and relocated to another area of the country. And it took me months to track this guy down. But I found him and I got him. And he's like really great. And then also I got the only person of interest in the case. And he talked, but he didn't do himself any favors.
Wow.
When he talked.
Wow.
So
amazing.
Can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah, he just kind of, you know, it's his wife who's missing. So you would think that you would have something to say about your wife who's missing. And he's like, and I don't think I have anything to offer. So he says, oh, nothing new has come up. So again, this is somebody who spoke to the police one time 19 years ago. And lawyered up and has never spoken again. So, you know, to me, but for being a local case, you know how when you can like actually go out and look at the area and get a vision of what someplace looks like and how it helps you. I know you guys went out to the scene where Mara's car was found. Since this was local, I could go out to where this woman's car was found abandoned and kind of take in the area and all this stuff. So, there's actually a picture from the turnpike here of her car going through an exit, and it looks like there's a body slumped over in the passenger side. So,
wow,
it's an interesting
incredible
one. Yeah,
we'll be looking forward to that. That's amazing.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I'm trying to do is get like all of these people. Now the police won't always talk; it depends on the case. But I'm trying to get more, because sometimes people say, "Oh, well, this episode was biased because you only talked to this one person." But sometimes there's nobody else who's willing to talk. So I don't ever say to people, "No, I won't cover your case because X, Y, Z." I always try to work with what I can get, but. Yeah, I'm trying to like dig a little bit deeper into each case while still keeping a weekly show.